Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to We Are History. Je suis Jean O'Farrell.
Oh, I see what you've done there. Et je suis Angela Barnes.
Angela's chosen today's subject, and all I'm going to say on the matter is that I told her there is no way she can do it all in one episode.
Right, you should know better, John, than to say something like that to me, because that just made me go, oh, well, I'll bloody show him and I'm going to do it all in one episode. And that means I've spent this week trying to fit the entire French Revolution. It's roughly an hour.
Can't you do it, listeners?
We'll find out. Hopefully in less than an hour. Let's see if I can do it.
This podcast comes in seven parts.
It's quite a big ask, the French Revolution, but I wanted to do it because I realised I actually know very little about it. I remember the 200th anniversary of the storming of the Bastille, do you know, in 1989. Do you remember that day, John?
Yeah, I wrote a sketch for Spitting Image on that. That's the difference between our ages.
I was at school and we were allowed to eat croissants in our French lesson that day.
What a progressive French teacher you had.
And our French teacher gave us all a French name to use for the rest of the term, and mine was Annick.
I'm going to call you Annick for the rest
Je
of this
suis
podcast.
Annick.
Annick.
So I think basically I sort of vaguely knew when the French Revolution was and what, but in my mind it was sort of some peasants woke up on the morning of 14th of July, stormed the Bastille, chopped the king's head off, then home in time for a coq au vin. Like it all happened in an afternoon, you know. But actually,
they wouldn't have been able to afford coq au vin for a start.
Well, no, that's peasant food, coq au vin. Come on,
vin.
Your van, maybe. Yeah, cheap Van Rouge.
All right, bit okay, of
van,
but anyway.
Coco Plonk. But anyway, of course, it was actually a period of about 10 years in this kind of massive swirl of conflicting ideas and people and motivations and philosophies.
Yeah, and it wasn't an uprising of the poor to overthrow the king by any sense, was it?
No, that's sort of what I think I thought it was, but it isn't at all. So today, what I'm going to do, John, is I've planned... J'ai plané.
So good, your French.
I'm better at German than French, I think it's fair to say. I'm going to do a sort of French Revolution for dummies. Right. That's what this is. French Revolution 101, if you like. So don't write in and tell me all the interesting things that I've missed out, because I'm going to be galloping through it. I'm going to skip through some key events, key people, and see if we can do a potted history of the French Revolution in one episode of We Are History.
Do write in, everyone. It would be good to see how annoying
Thank
that is.
God.
Maybe we'll come back to it in more detail in future episodes. I don't know. But it is fascinating stuff and one of the most important things to happen in modern history, really.
Yeah, it is. I'll be honest, though, John, right now I never want to think about the French Revolution ever again after this week.
This is a lot of research, yeah. Okay. So let's head to 18th century France. It's the age of enlightenment. Diderot, Voltaire, Rousseau, challenging the status quo. The idea of absolute monarchy and the power of the Catholic Church. It's the age of reason, science. People are starting to question the Ancien Régime.
Yeah.
Am I right?
That's right, yeah. So France, like much of Europe at this time, society sort of divided into these three estates of the realm. Mm-hmm. They call them. So you had the first estate was the clergy, the second estate was the nobility, and the third estate was your peasants and your bourgeoisie, your urban middle classes, your nouveau riche. So I made it sound like the third estate was Essex, but it's basically the third estate is everyone who isn't noble or clergy.
I get it.
Yeah.
And of course, your bourgeoisie, they could buy their way into the second estate, couldn't they? You could buy titles, but the nobles there were distinguished as noblesse de robe, nobles of the robe, as opposed to your original nobles, noblesse d'épée, nobles of the sword.
Yeah, your OG nobles, yeah.
Yeah.
Noble, you don't know what that means, do you, OG? You've skipped over that.
What is OG?
OG, original gangster. But
original
like
gangster.
OG.
Oh, see, no point talking to me about original
Listen
gangster.
Listen to me like I'm down with the youth.
Yeah. There was a massive problem that they'd been flogging off these titles to avoid tax. You didn't pay tax if you're a noble.
That's so right. That's... You can talk, Lord of Sealand.
Yeah, Angela's bought me a title. That's why I don't pay tax in this country.
That's right, isn't it?
I don't pay any tax on Sealand at all. So then your lowest, tell us about the peasants.
Yeah, so the lowest of the lower classes were your peasants. They were known as sans-culottes.
Okay.
Culottes were a type of silk breeches. They were fashionable among the clergy and the nobility, and peasants didn't wear them. So sans-culottes, without breeches.
Wait, so all the poor people in France were walking around without trousers?
No, they wore trousers, John. They weren't walking around like Winnie the Pooh with just their top halves dressed. No, they wore pantaloons or long trousers, not culottes. That's
I'm,
the point.
I'm glad we cleared that up. Good. Because the standards of French personal hygiene.
Oh, John, don't start that now. Oh, my God, we're not even 10 minutes in and the xenophobia started.
So, France, probably unlike Britain at this time, but France was an absolute monarchy, hereditary through the divine right of kings, much like most of Europe. Yeah. At this point,
I like absolute monarchy. It makes it sound like monarchy is a euphemism for shambles. France was an absolute monarchy.
Louis XVI is on the throne with his famous queen of Austrian heritage, Marie Antoinette, of course, famous for the "Let them eat cake."
Well, actually, let's get that clear right now. Because the story is, isn't it, that her reaction to there were severe bread shortages at the time among the poor in France, and her reaction was to say, well, let them eat cake. But there's actually no evidence that she said it. Didn't happen.
Yeah. It happened.
It didn't happen, John.
It's better. Print the myth.
I know it's better for the drama that it happened, but it didn't happen. Apparently, it was a line from a story by Rousseau, and he wrote it long before she'd even come to France, so it was just used to smear her. But anyway, absolute monarchy means the king, Louis XVI, not the strongest of leaders, I think it's fair to say.
Okay.
He had the power to make laws, levy taxes, control the military, all of it.
And then, in January 1789, a clergyman, the Abbé Sieyès, published a pamphlet in which he wrote, "What is the Third Estate? Everything. What has it been until now in the political order? Nothing. What does it demand to be? Something." It's great writing, this.
He's got a good English accent Abbé. That French clergyman.
Pointing out that the largest group of people in France had no real political voice. So he plants the seed that there should be some sort of national assembly, including members of the Third Estate, to represent their interests alongside those of the nobles and the king.
Yeah, exactly. And the clergy. So France at the time was divided into these 13 regional parlements. Mm-hmm. Although they've got the same root as our word, parliament, these weren't legislative bodies.
Yes.
So they had the power, weak powers really, to, they could, regionally, they could approve or reject the laws and edicts made by the king.
Right.
So they provided some checks and balances, but basically had the final say. And they weren't representative of the people as a whole. They only really protected the interests of regional nobles above everything else. Right. So it wasn't, a sort of fair system of government.
Right. So the only place that represented the interests of the Third Estate at all, i.e. anyone who wasn't clergy or noble, were the Estates General, is that right?
The Estates General, yes. So the Estates General, this was an advisory body that could be convened, and it would only be convened in times of extreme hardship.
Okay.
And it had deputies were elected to the Estates General that represented each of the three estates. So you'd have your First Estate, Second Estate and Third Estate come together as the Estates General.
Okay.
To vote on the issues that it had been convened to address.
Sounds good in theory, Angela. Yeah. But in practice, they were rarely convened, were they? And the king could just choose whether or not to abide by their votes anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And also, each of the three estates just had one vote. So despite the Third Estate representing like 80% of the population or something, far greater number of people, they only had one vote. And of course, the interests of the nobility and the clergy, the other two estates, were far more aligned.
Yes, of course.
So they would almost always be outvoted. So the vast majority of people's interests, even by the Estates General, weren't really represented at all.
It sort of comes back to what we were talking about with the Glorious Revolution, about if you left it to the king just to, trust his good nature, it's never going to work. That's why you've got to have proper checks and balances.
Exactly.
Listen to our Glorious Revolution people, which happened exactly 100 years before all this.
Yes.
So the king did decide to convene the Estates General in May of 1789, and it was the first time it happened since 1614. So you can imagine what a rare move that was and how much frustration had built up about their inability to sort of articulate all the things that they wanted to go on about.
Yeah. So the reason the king called the Estates General to meet in the middle of 1789 in May is because France at this point is pretty much bankrupt. It had lost a lot of its money financially supporting the Americans in the American War of Independence.
Yes.
And it was still paying the price for the 7 years war, which how long did that last again, John?
No one will ever know.
We simply don't know, do we? There's no research.
And
also the royal family were extravagant spenders, you'll be surprised to hear. Louis XVI and his wife Marie Antoinette, not exactly in the we're all in this together, we'll tighten our belts camp.
It could never happen today, as they say on a certain podcast.
Let's put that on a mug.
Yeah.
France at the time still had a feudal tax system, a pretty regressive tax system.
Right.
And of course, there were exemptions for the nobility and the clergy, meaning that the tax burden was pretty much all on the poorest people in society. And this, along with successive poor harvests, food shortages, it all makes for a not exactly content Third Estate.
And they said, where's our bread? And Marie Antoinette said, let them eat cake.
Famously. That's why she definitely said it.
That.
Definitely. You were there, weren't you, John?
I was there.
You heard her.
I don't even know what that is. Laissez-le manger du ghetto or something. It's probably said in Austrian German. Anyway, the finance minister at the time was a Swiss banker called Jacques Necker. He was very popular with the French people because he believed in transparency and he published detailed reports on government expenditure, royal expenditure. And he was sort of seen as competent and trustworthy and trying to introduce reforms to improve the financial situation that France was in.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's right. So on the 5th of May, King calls the Estates General to meet in Versailles to discuss this financial situation they're in. And the debate becomes heated pretty quickly over this issue we've already mentioned about voting, about it not being fair, representation. And so obviously the Third Estate people, and remember, it's not made up of peasants in the Estates General. These are lawyers, these are businessmen, these are, you know, the bourgeoisie, really. And they wanted to make representation equal across the three estates, so they favoured a vote per head approach.
Yes.
But unsurprisingly, the First and Second Estates, they quite like things as they were, really.
Yeah,
and it were in favour of the existing one vote per estate approach so they could maintain their own interests.
So the estates began meeting separately, didn't they?
Yeah.
And then on the 17th of June, oh, we're getting quite close, 17th of June, 1789, the deputies of the Third Estate formed a national assembly to represent the people of France, which
That's
is quite a bold
right.
move, isn't it?
So this was like Abbé Sieyès' idea. They start to put it into practice.
Right.
And then on the 20th of June, they make their way to the room in the Palace of Versailles where they always met, the Third Estate, and they found themselves locked out.
Ah, the king had locked them out on purpose? Was it double booked by the chess club? Again,
well,
no one knows.
Well, they assumed the king locked them out on purpose, but who knows, really? It could be that the whole course of human history, John, was changed because a caretaker overslept. Who knows? But anyway, one of them, one of the deputies, a certain Dr. Guillotin.
Name sounds familiar.
Yeah. He suggests that they meet instead at an indoor tennis court that he knows
of. Course, yeah.
So they all gather there. And at this meeting, they vow not to disband until they've established a constitution for France, right? And this is a vow they make that becomes known as the tennis court oath.
Wow. That's,
yeah, a bit of a shame, really. That's not why we remember Dr. Guillotin, isn't
yeah,
it?
You have
I feel
to
a bit sorry for him.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the guillotine was his idea, not because he wanted to cut people's heads off. It was because he wanted to find a more humane way to carry out the death penalty.
Yeah.
Which up to that point involved hanging people or strapping them to a water wheel till they died.
Yeah, so he was a doctor. He just wanted a more clinical, humane way of doing it. But now his name's sort of associated with this kind of, let's say, period that comes later. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. So they hold this vote to formally establish this new assembly that would be able to make laws of its own.
Right.
And the assembly now, that so you had the Third Estate with the core of it, but members of the clergy voted to join the assembly and a couple of nobles as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this is starting to amount really to an act of insurrection. And they know this,
yes.
But the vote is still unanimous, apart from one person apparently.
Oh, God, I know that person.
Yeah, do it. Well,
there's always one of them at the meeting.
Always one at the meetings, yeah. And so a few days later, on the 23rd of June, the king addresses the Estates General. And he immediately invalidates all the decisions this National Assembly's made. You can't do that.
Yes.
And he tells the three estates that they must continue to meet separately. They can't get together and form a National Assembly. They have to continue to meet separately. And the king leaves, but the majority of the Assembly, they stay in the hall defiantly. And when they're asked again to leave, the Comte de Mirabeau who's sort of one of the leaders of the tennis court oath that happened. Yes. He shouts back to them, "We are assembled here by the will of the people," that old phrase, "and that they would leave only at the point of a bayonet."
Ooh. Then, 2 days later, after this, 48 more nobles join the National Assembly, including the king's cousin, the Duke of Orléans. Bit awkward.
Yeah, a bit awkward. Yeah.
Christmas.
So now the king sort of reluctantly has to accept that this National Assembly has formed and it is a legitimate body, and he has to begin to recognise its authority, whether he wants to or not.
Yeah, except at the same time, he's also started to organise troops, largely composed of Swiss and German mercenaries, and he told them to come to Paris just to be on the safe side.
Yeah, that's right. He's like, yeah, OK, you can have your assembly. Oh, don't mind all these massive Swiss blokes turning up. Yeah, no, they are big, aren't they? No, they're just here to service my cuckoo clocks. Nothing more. Don't worry about them.
Swiss mercenaries, though. I mean, what weapons would they have? They'd be able to get a stone out of a horse's.
I knew there'd be
stone
a Swiss.
Out of horse's
I almost wrote a Swiss Army knife joke, and I thought, no, John will take care of that. Don't worry about that.
You've got to do it. Got to finish. Always got to tap it away. So, is it beginning of July? A committee of 30 members of the Assembly is formed to write the new constitution. I have to say, Angela, that sounds like an absolute nightmare from a writer's point of view.
Right,
I'm sitting
it?
There going, 30 people in the room writing
document.
Together. And, I've been in those sort of writers' meetings. Oh, you couldn't do it. Should have been like two at maximum.
Yeah.
A lot of people to write a document. I'm just amazed they ever got bothered to the first draft. For
yeah, quite. Right. Then on the 11th of July, so we're getting close, John, to that famous day.
14 juillet.
On the 11th of July, the king, out of nowhere, sacks Necker, you know, the popular
finance guy,
just
yeah.
sacks him. Right?
And the Parisians are angry at this because we said he was popular, didn't we? He's the only one they actually trusted.
Yeah.
So they take to the streets, the French. They ransack a monastery. That's quite easy to do, actually. Monks don't fight back, do they?
I don't know. I think 18th century monks are
pretty
hard compared to today's monks.
Right.
They're not Buddhist.
You're looking at my Bible.
Yeah, exactly.
You're spilling my wine. They burn the customs.
That's
true. Burn the custom barriers, and there's skirmishes between the king's guard and the angry masses. And
I imagine a similar thing would happen if Rishi sacked Jeremy Hunt.
Oh, the
people would take to the streets.
They'd be furious.
So because of this increasing unrest, on the 13th of July, the National Assembly declares itself in permanent session at the City Hall, and they begin to form a governing committee and an armed militia. So they mean business.
So they're actually armed. Their assembly now has military representation. Mm. The problem is that the representatives of the Third Estate, they were mostly like lawyers and educated bourgeoisie, weren't they? They weren't fighting men. Yeah. So they send for 200 patriots from each region to prepare to bear arms and to form the new National Guard.
Yeah, thousands of them came.
Wow.
And while this was happening, there's still just mobs of people on the streets of Paris, and they're looking for weapons, basically anything they can make weapons from, metal, for metal workers to make into pikes, whatever they can find. And then they get word that there is some gunpowder and other weapons being held at the prison fortress of dun-dun-dun, Bastille.
Of course. And this is the 14th of July, which is Bastille Day. So they thought this is the perfect day
perfect
to go
day,
down.
Perfect
which
day.
Which go
for...
there then. So the Bastille was built as a fortress originally in the 14th century. By 1789, it was a prison used by the monarchy to imprison enemies of the state.
Yes.
And it was sort of a symbol of royal authority, but it had a load of guns and gunpowder in it, they thought.
Yeah, yeah. So the mob headed down there. And funnily enough, the governor, not too keen on letting them all in.
No, I bet.
So he did his best to hold them back. He initially let in a couple of them to sort of negotiate over the gunpowder situation and delayed them, gave them some breakfast,
some
have another cup of tea.
Baguette.
Yeah.
Be nice breakfast.
I imagine croissant, yeah.
Coffee, the baguettes in the coffee, all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, lovely. Ooh, a bit of hot chocolate.
Hot chocolate.
And so he managed to delay things by a few hours.
Yeah, but in the meantime, people were trying to scale the walls and break down the door with crowbars or whatever they could get their hands on. And the defenders of the Bastille were firing cannons and muskets on the crowd to deter them, but seemed to make them more determined to get in. It's all kicking off now.
All kicking off. So eventually, someone from the crowds outside, they climb up onto this perfume shop and they jump from the perfume shop onto the top of the drawbridge outside the fortress, and they manage to break it down and get in. And then once they've opened that, the crowds flood inside, overwhelm the garrison that are there to protect the Bastille. They killed the governor. It was, you know, you sort of feel for him a bit. He's just kind of a like middle manager, just trying to do his job.
No.
Oh no! Killed him. Stuck his head on a pike. Paraded that around. Whenever when I hear that phrase, they right. stuck his head on a pike. I just hear, you know, that scene from Alan Partridge, like Lynn, I've got my head on a pike. You know when he puts his foot on the, I've got my foot on a spike.
Got my head on a pike.
Got my head on a pike.
Suddenly,
Lynn.
The governor of the Bastille is Alan Partridge.
Yeah. So anyway, they break through, right? So they all storm in, all flood in, and they kill the governor and they kill all the guards. And then they think, right, let's go and release the prisoners. What right. a noble thing that would be to do. Release all the political prisoners. They get there. How many of them are there, John, do you reckon?
Famously not very many.
Seven. There's seven. There would have been eight.
Right.
But apparently the Marquis de Sade had been held there, but he'd moved out about 12 days earlier because the reason they moved him is out of a drain pipe, he improvised this megaphone and was using it to shout to people on the streets that the guards were murdering
okay.
them. So they thought they put him in an insane asylum.
Would have given him 20 lashes, but he would have enjoyed it.
Yeah, exactly, right? And then of the seven that remained, one of them thought he was Julius Caesar.
Right, could have been.
And another one of them, he refused to leave until he'd finished his dinner of roast pheasant.
Can't say I blame him. There were food shortages and he was probably like, no, don't release me. I get three good meals a day here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but roast pheasant, it's better than most prison food, isn't it? It's not your porridge.
Incidentally, my husband's birthday is on the 14th of July.
Ah.
Yeah, so we've both got good revolutionary birth dates.
Is your birthday 9th of
yeah,
November? You've never
it.
Mentioned that before. No, there's nothing
it.
Happened in Germany on the 9th of November.
No,
ever,
nothing.
Ever.
Nothing at all. No.
Well, it sounds like that might be a good place to take a break. Anik?
Yes, I think it's a good idea. Well, you've got to ring Amazon Customer Services, haven't you? See why they haven't delivered that period you bought last week.
I'm a Lord of Sealand, you know. Hello and welcome back to We Are History. We've just stormed the Bastille on Bastille Day. So surely the revolution is pretty much done by now, Angela, is that right?
God, I wish it was, John. Right, so the following day, 15th of July, we're on now, the astronomer and mathematician Jean-Sylvain Bailly is named mayor of Paris, and the Marquis de Lafayette. Now, he's right. the guy who he fought in the Continental Army in the American
yes.
War of Independence. So they appoint him the commander of the newly formed National Guard.
Yes, everything. All these streets in America are Lafayette Street. And I think he's in Hamilton as well. Anyway, on the 16th of July, the king reinstates Necker as finance minister and withdraws his troops from the centre of Paris to try and calm tensions.
Yes, I think it's important to remember there's still, you know, we've had the Bastille, but there is still an absolute monarchy at this point.
Yes.
Like they haven't just, it didn't all happen in an afternoon.
No.
No monarchy's been overthrown. So while the king has been forced to recognise the National Assembly, he still has his veto.
Yes, I mean, the storming of the Bastille is like a symbol of the revolution. It's
yeah.
not the key event, really.
No.
It's just been plucked out as a day in which they celebrate it.
Yeah, exactly.
It wasn't the goal of the people in charge of the new assembly to overthrow the monarchy either.
Yeah, that wasn't
point.
The goal of the revolution
no.
at the start. It wasn't.
Yeah.
And we know that, but one of the you know, the tricolour cocade
yes,
thing,
the thing on their hats.
Which is the sort of rosette thing, the
yeah,
red, white,
red,
blue,
white, blue
rosette. Well, the white ribbon, which was added to it,
yeah.
is that symbolises loyalty to the sovereign.
Oh, wow.
So they were wearing the cockade with that symbolisation
oh,
in it. So, you know, the principal motives of those that were initiated the revolution wasn't to overthrow a monarchy. That's the point we're making.
Similar to the English Civil War. They never set out to chop the king's head off. It just, that ended up,
just whoops.
Know, whoops.
Someone slipped
we've
with an axe, right? That's
yes.
what happened. So that's not to say, though, John, that there weren't rumblings of a more radical revolution happening at the same time.
Sure.
There certainly were people in France who did want a republic. For example, Camille Desmoulins, he was a radical revolutionary and he published La France Libre, this was Free France, which was
that,
calling
yeah.
for a republic. And he argued that violent means to get it were justified.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we know what's going on in Paris, but what about the rest of France? Are they all carrying on regardless?
Well, the sort of rural unrest in France had begun long before the events of the summer of 1789.
Yeah.
Because they'd had this series of poor harvests. There'd been an Icelandic volcanic eruption in 1783.
All flights cancelled.
All flights cancelled. Big ash cloud.
Yeah.
In 1788, there'd been storms and floods, vines ruined by frost. So there were lots of vagrancy in rural areas. Lots of people lost their land.
Yeah.
So they were struggling. They'd been struggling for a long time. And then by the spring of 1789, there were grain shortages, which led to bread shortages.
Yeah.
So they were having a tough time in the countryside. And when you're having a tough time, you look for reasons for it, right?
Yeah.
So it was at this time, after the Bastille, when this great conspiracy theory started. And the conspiracy theory in rural areas was that there was a famine plot whereby the aristocracy were deliberately trying to starve the population to death. Okay. That's what they thought.
Well, so they obviously didn't trust the aristocracy at all.
No.
So the events in Paris really fueled this climate of fear across the country.
Yeah.
Some of the sans-culottes began to believe that they could seize land and property from the aristocracy, so they took up arms and they formed militias to defend themselves.
Yeah, this period became known as La Grande Peur, the Great Fear. Because all these peasants started arming themselves. In some areas, they started to attack the local manor houses. There were peasant revolts in Strasbourg, Le Mans, Hainaut, other regions. So there's a real climate of fear and paranoia in the Great Fear, it was called that period. There was one theory that I don't know how much to... I couldn't find any evidence anywhere else but this one article I read. It's this historian, Mary Kilbourne Matossian, and she thinks that this paranoia was caused because they were starving. They were all started eating this fungus called ergo, a hallucinogenic fungus, and they would mix it with the rye. And, they think that that caused this sort of mass hysteria. I don't know how true that is, but it's quite fun.
Yeah, because if in years of good harvest, you'd throw away the stuff that was didn't have the fungus on, but bad years, you'd eat the hallucinogenic stuff, start tripping out and going, oh man, it's all a big conspiracy, man. It was a third man on the grassy knoll.
Exactly.
It wasn't, it was an FBI conspiracy. I definitely think that's true. I love that idea. The Great Fear dissipates when the new assembly starts to announce the August Decrees, a series of proclamations. 19 decrees in all, Angela.
Yeah, don't worry, we're not going to go for all of them.
Right.
The most important, really, the first was they abolished the feudal system.
Right.
So that means the end of tithes, the end of feudal taxes. This is good for the poor people.
Yeah.
And they proclaimed that everyone would be seen as equal in the eyes of the law, and that there would be religious freedom and freedom of speech. So it's a Catholic country, and up to this point, you know, there wasn't religious freedom.
No.
In fact, emancipation for Jews came a little bit later, but it was starting to happen.
Yes. Then on the 27th of August, the Assembly adopts the Declaration of Rights of Man and of the Citizen.
Yes.
Which was a sort of human rights document initially drafted by Abbé Sieyès and Lafayette with a bit of help from his old pal Thomas Jefferson, inspired as it was by the US Declaration of Independence. One thing I'd say about all of this is that there'd been a revolution in America 20 years earlier. So they'd, sort of 10 years earlier, really. And they'd seen that it was possible to overthrow a major world power. And it sort of, you know, really informed what happened here, I think, because the sense of what the Americans did to the British and indeed what the British did to their monarchy 100 years before.
Yeah, absolutely. So this document becomes the basis for France as a nation of free individuals protected equally by the law. And it was sort of the first step towards writing a constitution for France. The Assembly was still, remember, not as a whole advocating a republic.
Yeah.
Right? In fact, the more conservative elements of the Assembly were still advocating for a bicameral system, you know, whereby there's an upper house and that the king would retain his power to veto any legislation. So it would still have that absolute power.
But on the 10th of September, the majority of the Assembly voted in favour of a single legislative body. And the following day approved a suspensive veto, which meant the king could delay implementation of law, but could no longer block it completely.
So while all this is going on, the more radical elements among the revolutionaries are agitating for a republic.
Oh, yes.
The scientist and political theorist Jean-Paul Marat. I don't know how to say it.
I think you put a T on that, actually.
I think
Marat.
You do, don't you? Marat.
Guy in the bath.
Let's say it. We'll say it, anglicise it.
He's the guy in the bath. With
Oh, Jean-Paul Marat.
Yeah.
he published pamphlets denouncing the reforms, and he became a voice of the radical faction of the revolution, representing the sans-culottes. You know, he tried to incite uprisings to block this proposed suspensive veto. He felt it hadn't gone far enough. And in mid-September, he began publication of a radical newspaper called L'Ami du Peuple, Friend of the People. Not to be confused with long-running British Women's Weekly, People's Friend.
Far fewer puzzles and knitting patterns. No knitting patterns at all.
None at all. As far as I know, John, I've not seen a copy of you.
You've not done your research, Angela.
Might have knit yourself a red, white and blue jumper.
A little cockade.
Knit your own cockade,
Meanwhile, as Marat is busy stirring up the sans-culottes, the king is reinforcing his royal guard with members of the Flanders regiment that he's brought in.
Yeah, so he brought in the Swiss, brought in the Germans, now he's bringing in the Belgians.
Blimey.
Yeah.
That's not going to go down well.
When these new guardsmen arrived, he did what he always did. He threw them a welcome banquet, right? It was a traditional thing to do. But the radical press, by this point, they reported on this banquet. And they reported it as if it was this gluttonous orgy, which it probably was. But they insinuated that during the proceedings, the king had in some way, and the way it's written here is how it's written in most places I've read it. I don't know what he did to it, but in some way he abused the tricolour cockade. I mean, it makes it sound like he stuck it up his ass.
I don't think he did.
I think he trod on it. Who knows what he did at it? And they got angry.
You can fire at protesters, you can spend all of our money, but do not abuse our cockade. Outrageous. I'll tell you what probably happened there is that they said, the people outside are hungry, and Marie Antoinette said, let them eat cake.
That's what happened, John. Yeah, that definitely happened more than once.
She kept saying it. It was her catchphrase.
That's all she ever said. It was a catchphrase.
Do the cake line, Marie.
So it's fair to say, Sans-Culottes, not happy about this.
Yeah.
So on the 5th of October, a large crowd of mostly women, actually, they gathered and they marched to the City Hall to voice their grievances.
Yes. And then, there were thousands eventually, and they marched down to the Palace of Versailles, which is quite a long way. It's about 12 miles southwest of Paris.
Yeah.
And then the women, who by now have been joined by Lafayette and the National Guard, surrounded the palace and demanded to see the king. And after what had been a peaceful march, some of the women saw this, and they broke into the palace. They thought they could find the queen's chambers and speak with her.
Yeah. Apparently, I love the story of this. In different places I've read, the accounts go that, like, the women were, you know, want an equal right. They want to fight against the monarch. And then they get there, and they get into the palace. It's all a bit overwhelming. They're all charmed by the king. Apparently, one woman fainted at the beauty of the place.
Oh, my God.
And it all somewhat undermines the point that you're making. It's like, we demand to be treated as equal citizens. Oh, where did you get that vase? It's lovely. So... anyway, eventually Lafayette persuaded the king that the best idea would probably be to calm things down, because there's thousands of people there.
Yeah, hard to argue with that many people.
It's hard to argue that. So I think you should come back to Paris with the crowd, because that's what they wanted him to come back to Paris and answer to their, the questions. So he marched back with them, and they made him wear the Cap of Liberty with a cockade on it.
Wow.
En route, which he wore. So that's quite a statement
it
from
is.
The king. And the royal family moved into the Tuileries. I know, poor things, being dragged out of their massive palace to have to live in, let me check my notes, another massive palace.
Back in Paris, the king announced his acceptance of the August decrees, and the declaration and his official title changed from King of France to King of the French. Dun, dun, dun.
Subtle difference, but important, John.
I don't see it myself.
Meanwhile, unbeknownst to the assembly, the king, while outwardly, saying yes to the decrees and accepting the new regime and the new assembly and everything, he's also sneakily sending messages to all the royals in places like Austria, England, Prussia,
dear.
The United Provinces, asking them if they wouldn't mind awfully staging an invasion of France.
Right.
Not the most patriotic of actions, but what he's hoping is that if a foreign army can come in, defeat the new assembly, then he could be restored as the absolute monarch.
Oh dear, that's not good. That's not a good move, Louis. What are you thinking? So during the period following the March on Versailles, France was getting used to being a society where 60% of the men had the vote compared to precisely 0% a few months earlier. All these different political factions now had to get their message out to these new voters. There were no political broadcasts in the 18th century, so they relied on vast numbers of pamphlets, debates in church halls across the country, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. All these different factions begin to emerge, from the most radical, who are adamant about preventing any restoration of a monarchy and moving the nation towards becoming a republic.
Yeah.
They were represented by those like Marat.
Yeah.
And then you had those who mostly represented the more wealthy bourgeoisie. So they were still a third estate, but they'd wanted the revolution to give them themselves a political voice, but that was quite enough now.
Yeah.
They weren't altogether happy about the rights it had given to the sans-culottes, to the really poor people. It's like, all right, lads, you've had your fun. That'll do now. Let's just stop it. And they were represented by Mirabeau, who supported the king. He would also later become president of the assembly. What the assembly didn't know at the time was that Mirabeau actually was on the king's payroll. He was given the brief to save the monarchy. So they're pulling in different directions in the assembly itself.
So it comes to the first anniversary of the storming of the Bastille. They hold a big ceremonial do in Paris. And at this event, Lafayette, who's still chief of the National Guard, and the king both publicly pledge themselves to the law, the nation, and the king. Yes, the king pledges himself to himself.
It's got to be the easiest pledge in the world, isn't it? I pledge to serve me.
Yes.
It was a formal event. And when you think about it, it's quite a far cry from the events it's commemorating.
Yeah.
You know, the ones with these sans-culottes rampaging through the city with improvised weapons.
Yeah, this revolution wasn't looking anything like what the radicals were hoping it would be.
No. It's all, you know, still pomp and ceremony and monarchy. So the following year, and with no invasion so far to save the king, and he's seeing the way the more radical wind could be blowing, the royal family start making plans, John, to escape.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so on the night of the 20th of June, 1791, they leave the palace in the Tuileries by a secret back gate, which apparently Marie Antoinette knew that there was a gate they could escape out of because that's the gate she let her lover in.
Is it?
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, imagine the king being, oh, how did you know that gate was there? Oh, I just stumbled across it one day. Oh, wow. Surprised me as much as you.
But anyway. A cake maker as well probably came in there as
Yeah, probably. That's right. So they flee and they head for Varennes, which is a northeastern town.
Yes.
And there they've arranged to meet some royalist supporters, sympathetic foreign troops, and they fled in disguise as ordinary citizens.
Right.
But when their stagecoach stops at a staging post, the son of the postmaster comes along and he recognises the king, John. Do you know how he recognises the king?
He's off the banknotes.
From his picture on the banknotes. Isn't that brilliant?
He's got 20 francs painted across his forehead. Right. It's like such a giveaway. Oh dear, that's hilarious. So the boy went and alerted people in the town that the king was at a local inn, and then this big mob gathered, didn't it?
Yeah, to detain him. Yeah. I'm surprised they believed him. I'm surprised they weren't like, yeah, mate, of course he is. And Jesus Christ just called in at the cobbler's. I recognised him from that picture in the church window.
So the royal family returned under guard to Paris, and the assembly suspended the king's functions as a constitutional monarch, effectively placing him and his family under house arrest in the Tuileries.
So wait, John, when you think about it, what you're telling me there is that they literally would have got away with it if it hadn't been for that pesky kid. Isn't that okay?
I hope he had a dog.
Only we could bring Scooby-Doo into a podcast about the French Revolution.
This all happened in history.
It all happened. And the Scooby-Doo said, let them eat cake. That's what happened, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely.
So the assembly, who are actually still trying to conserve the monarchy at this stage, remember?
Yeah.
They must have been like, for crying out, Louis, you're not making this easy.
No.
Like, could you just stay put? So they put out the story that the royal family hadn't run away. They didn't run away, John. They'd actually been kidnapped and they were taken to Varennes against their will.
Yeah, but of course, the actions of the royal family were seen as a betrayal and really bolstered support for the more radical factions within the assembly. Calls for the abolition of the monarchy and the formation of a republic. It gathered momentum and aristocrats started leaving France in greater numbers to appear in Blackadder.
Yes, right. There's a great story of this aristocratic woman. She was fleeing on her stagecoach. She spots those crowds jeering them as they flee. And she spots this woman in the crowd, which was had been her wet nurse.
Oh, wow.
And she's jeering and she responds, the ingratitude. They've still got this idea that the poor people should be grateful that they ever had employment in the first place.
That's hilarious. 17th of July, just a few days after the second anniversary of the storming of the Bastille, crowds gathered on the Champ du Mars to sign a petition calling for the removal of Louis XVI and the establishment of a republic.
Yes, but old Lafayette, who is still, you know, advocating the monarchy, he ordered the National Guard to disperse the crowd and they eventually opened fire, killing dozens of demonstrators.
Oh,
it's a bit of a turning point that in people's attitudes, I think.
Yes.
But regardless, 2 months later, the king formally accepted the new constitution and in October, the new legislative assembly held its first session with the monarchist Claude Pastoret as its president.
Right. But then in 1792, Austria and Prussia agreed that they would invade France and defend the monarchy under the command of the Duke of Brunswick.
That's right.
And in April, the assembly declares war on the King of Bohemia and Hungary. The revolutionary wars have started and the king is hopeful one of these invading armies will get him his full monarchy back, complete with cake.
That's right. Of course, life still wasn't great for your average citizen either. There were still severe food shortages. There'd been a slave uprising in Haiti.
We know a podcast about that.
We do have that. Listen, that led to sugar and coffee shortages.
Oh,
and you can't deprive prisoners of their coffee, John, or hell will break loose.
Sacre bleu.
Yes.
And you had all these political clubs trying to persuade the people that their ideas for how this revolution should continue were the right ideas.
Yes. So you had, there's all these clubs at the time and you had the Cordeliers. They represented the radicals. radical left. Then you had the Jacobin, who also represented the left. Then you had the Girondins, and they were a group of moderates who had split from the Jacobin. Oh, you following this?
Yes.
So Paris just became a sea of pamphlets, and you couldn't move for political debates and arguments in village halls and salons and coffee houses.
Socialist worker, and it's exactly. All the different paper sellers outside going, overthrow the Jacobins, Jacobin splitters.
Exactly. So
in July, the Assembly made the decision to allow working class citizens, i.e. those who pay no taxes, to join the National Guard as it needed to fight off the invading powers. However, the volunteers tended towards the Jacobin, and this would ultimately have the result of turning the National Guard from a force that would protect the monarchy into a Republican revolutionary force.
Yeah, that's right. There's the stories of these volunteers. They all marched from Marseille up to Paris to join up.
Wow.
And they were singing this hip new tune, John, as they marched. It was called the Chant de Guerre pour l'Armée du Rhin, the war song for the Army of the Rhine. And of course, that would soon become known as... Not the Birdie song, John. No, it's La Marseillaise, you know, which of course became the anthem of the revolution and the French national...
It's a much better anthem.
My dad used to sing an alternate version of that. I won't sing it on the podcast. I won't, but it did involve a Frenchman going to the lavatory and ended with Oué le papier. I remember that, but anyway.
Okay. It's a much better national anthem than ours, isn't it? It's a really stirring sort of song.
Ours is a dirge, isn't
it? Yeah. And if you want to give yourself a treat, watch the scene from Casablanca where they sing La Marseillaise against the German singers. Angela, you've still not watched Casablanca, have you?
Watch Casablanca.
There's a great Battle of the Bands scene in Casablanca where they sing it, and it's a very moving moment. Anyway,
9th of August, 1792, the lawyer and prominent member of the left-wing Cordelier, a Georges Danton.
Yeah.
I think he was known as a bit of a party dude.
Oh, yeah.
Him and some of his radical allies took over the Paris city government. This is an important moment, this.
Yes.
Because they formed the revolutionary Paris Commune.
Oh, that's a bit ahead of themselves. They're 100 years ahead of the one we did.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. But the following day, the National Assembly had to recognise the Commune as the official Paris government.
Right.
And no sooner had they done that, the National Guard of the Paris Commune, including all these volunteers from Marseille, they stormed the king's residence in the Tuileries Paris.
I love the way you say Tuileries.
Tuileries.
Hundreds of the king's Swiss guards with their little knives and 400 revolutionaries were killed in this battle, while the king and his family, they took shelter in the legislative assembly. The assembly provisionally suspended the authority of the king, and they ordered the election of a new government.
Yeah, quite unbelievably, John, we've got this far into talking about the French Revolution, and we haven't mentioned Maximilien Robespierre yet. Or Maximilien Robespierre, he was a lawyer.
Yes, right.
Quite famously a Republican.
Yes.
And he campaigned for voting rights for all men.
And women, Angela?
No, don't be silly, John. Robespierre was a prominent member of this new Paris Commune. And following the events of August 1792, where they stormed the palace, he then insisted that the National Assembly should vote to create a revolutionary tribunal in order to deal with enemies of the revolution. Oh, this is taking a turn, this revolution.
It's taking a turn.
And he threatened that if they didn't vote for it, there would be an armed uprising.
Yeah, see, once you start talking about enemies of the revolution, it's sort of a license to kill anyone, isn't it?
Yeah.
It always goes horribly wrong.
Yeah.
This is why I'm such a moderate. Did they?
Did they vote for it? Yes, they did.
Yeah, yes.
The newly elected National Convention held its first session behind closed doors on the 20th of September. And of the 749 deputies, 113 of them now are these radical Jacobins.
Right.
And they become known as Montagnards. Have you heard that phrase? Because in the hall, they sat up on the high...
Montagnard means mountaineer, is that right?
Mountaineers. So the Montagnard, these radical Jacobins.
Yeah.
And then on the 22nd of September 1792, the monarchy was formally abolished.
Wow.
As one of the first acts of this new government. And the first French Republic was proclaimed.
Massive.
And the king and Marie Antoinette remained in prison.
So then, 1792, a discovery is made in the king's apartment in the palace of an iron strongbox, and in it are found secret correspondence between him and Mirabeau about their plans to save the monarchy and between him and the foreign monarchs that he's asked to invade France. So Robespierre, who's now the leader of the Jacobins and the first deputy for Paris in the new convention, he demands that the king be put to death.
Dun, 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 dun. So the new convention rules that there will be a vote on the king's death penalty, and each deputy must publicly declare his vote on the death penalty for the king.
Wow.
So on the 15th of January, they find him guilty of conspiracy against public liberty.
Was it a close vote, Angela?
It was 707-0. Oh, John, nobody dear. Dared not vote for the death king. Penalty for the king.
Wow.
So Louis XVI was beheaded at 10:22 on January the 21st, and the executioner ordered a drum roll so they could drown out any final words that he had for the crowd. And I think that's a good place to take another break. That wasn't the king's final words, by the way. I just think that's a good place to take a break.
His final words were, "She never said that thing about the cake." See you in a minute. Hello and welcome back to We Are History and to the First French Republic. It's 1793, a year that started with the execution of the king and will continue to be pretty bloody and pretty bloody radical,
yes,
Annick.
Quite. There are plenty of royalists still across France,
yeah,
and they do attempt to rise up now and again against this new convention, first of all in Brittany, and then in March there's a big uprising in the Vendée in the west, but the new convention are quick to put them all down, these uprisings. And then on the other hand, you had groups of people who didn't think the revolution had gone far enough and just killing the king. The enragés, they were called.
The enraged. Yes.
And they were a group of ultra-radicals who were defending the rights of the sans-culottes, because they felt what had happened was this new regime was serving the bourgeoisie, was serving the lawyers and merchants that it was made of. And they'd taken all the power, but it stopped short of really serving the lower classes.
In a portent of what is to come, the convention starts decreeing the death penalty for anyone suggesting any further radical reforms or anyone participating in any royalist uprising. Basically, anyone disagrees with us, we'll kill you.
Yes, that's it. So in April, the Committee of Public Safety was established, which sounds nice,
doesn't
it?
Sounds lovely.
Look after public safety, but be aware. This was the chief executive body of the government and it was formed to control this unrest.
Yes.
And Marat, who by now was president of the Jacobin Club, he was arrested for incitement to violence for his continued publication of Friend of the People, not People's Friend.
Right.
And he is eventually acquitted by the tribunal. And him and Robespierre then make a call to incite insurrection against the National Convention.
Okay.
They feel like, okay, it's not radical enough.
Yeah.
So at the end of May, an armed crowd of sans-culottes, stirred up by Marat and Robespierre, they storm the hall of the convention, demand that it disband, and the deputies resist them at first, but the sans-culottes and these soldiers of the Paris Commune, these volunteers from Marseille, they occupy the hall and they eventually stage a Montagnard coup d'etat. So on the 10th of June that year, the Montagnard, these left-wing group of the Jacobins, they gain control of the convention. We now have a radical convention.
Yes. So in July, Charlotte Corday, a member of the more moderate Girondin, kills Marat in his bath. Great painting. See it? I saw it at the National Art thing or somewhere. She says that she killed one man to save 100,000, for which she is guillotined.
Yes, that's right. So Robespierre is then elected to the Committee of Public Safety at the end of July. And by August, he's the president of the convention as well, the National Convention. And this is the beginning of what becomes known as La Terreur, or the Reign of Terror under Robespierre.
Yes.
And in September 1793, he passes the Law of Suspects. Sounds dodgy, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And it authorised the arrest and trial of anyone suspected of being an enemy of the Republic. I can't see how that can go wrong.
No. So Marie Antoinette, who'd been imprisoned since the execution of her husband at the beginning of the year, was taken to the Revolutionary Tribunal in October 1793, facing charges of conspiracy against the Republic, treason and crimes against the state, linking her to counter-revolutionary activity and attempts to get foreign intervention, which is, since she was a foreigner, sort of understandable. Mm. Anyway, she was found guilty and executed on the 16th of October, which was a bit of a shame.
She was. The Reign of Terror continued. Oh, you didn't do a letter me cake?
I thought I'd done enough of those.
I was expecting one.
Listeners, just listen out in case there's one more reference to cake. Who knows?
So the reign of terror continued. Robespierre justified it to the convention, saying the foundations of a popular government in a revolution are virtue and terror. Terror without virtue is disastrous, and virtue without terror is powerless. The government of the revolution is the despotism of liberty over tyranny.
Yes. Well, the terror also applied to internal factions, radicals. Georges Danton and Camille Desmoulins were both executed.
Yeah, no one was safe from the terror. Apart from Robespierre at that point. Well, actually, even
let's
he was.
See what happens. Don't go away.
Because by June 1794, the prisons are full.
Right.
Because he's gone mad.
Yeah.
Just accusing everybody. So he starts to speed up the trials. And the way he does this is he says, we don't need witnesses testifying anymore. That just takes too long.
Yeah.
And so as time went on, more and more prisoners were being found guilty, sentenced to death, with fewer and fewer acquittals, funnily enough.
And then he gives a violent speech, doesn't he, in July. And eventually the National Convention voted to arrest him.
Yes, they did. He actually attempted suicide. There's sort of conflicting things about whether he attempted suicide or whether a guard shot him.
Okay.
But either way, if he did it himself, he didn't do a very good job because he shot himself in the face.
Right.
And sort of missed. Except his jaw, which... apparently, when he was taken to the tribunal, it was held together with bandages, this jaw. And according to witnesses, when he was executed, spoiler alert, which he was, the bandage was removed by the executioner and his jaw just sort of fell off in front of the crowd.
I hope you're not listening to this while having your breakfast, listeners.
Lovely image, isn't it? His allies were also arrested, and altogether 106 Robespierreists, including Robespierre, were executed. Then all the prisoners that had been held under his law of suspects were released.
Right. After just under a year, Robespierre's reign of terror was over, a period during which about 16,500 suspects were formally executed after a trial, while about 10,000 died in prison, and thousands more were killed in various massacres across France. The final death toll of the terror is thought to be about 30,000, 50,000, something like that.
Something like Incredible. That, yeah. And the demise of Robespierre then marks the start of what they call, John, the Thermidorian reaction.
Which is something to do with lobster, is that right?
No. I'll explain, actually. I should have explained. Because while terribly violent, the First Republic wasn't all terror and choppy chop chop off with their heads. Mm-hmm. There were lots of changes at the time. For example, that's when the metric system of weights and measures was introduced.
Oh, yeah.
It was also when they divided Paris into the electoral districts that it still has today.
Yeah.
But there were some slightly less enduring and slightly more bonkers things that came in at that time. So, for example, one of the things Robespierre wanted to do was de-Christianize the Republic. The Catholic Church had too much power for too long.
Right, yes.
But rather than replace religion with atheism, being that this was the Age of Reason and the Age of Enlightenment, which is what you'd think they might do, he felt that that wasn't a good idea because atheism could lead to anarchy. There needed to be some sort of godhead in order to maintain the social order. So what he did, he introduced a civic religion, which he called the Cult of the Supreme Being, and he organised a festival of the Supreme Being.
Yeah, this isn't going to work.
No.
So just going back, I'm sorry to be picky, but what's this got to do with lobster Thermidor?
Yeah, now, I'm coming to that. That's got to do with the First Republic's new calendar that they introduced. Right. So they introduced something called decimal time. So there were 10 days a week.
Ridiculous.
And they restarted the calendar from year one.
Arrogant.
So there were still 12 months, but they changed the names of the months. Oh. So they named them, instead of being after Roman and Greek gods or whatever, they named them after weather that reflected the seasons they occurred in. So Brumaire, which means mist, started at the end of October in the autumn. You see, and Prairial, meaning meadow, started in mid-May. So Thermidor... Right. was from mid-July because it meant summer heat. See? Makes sense, doesn't
it? So the Thermidorian reaction was a reaction that began in Thermidor in the summer.
Yeah, nothing to do with lobster.
Okay, I really fancy lobster now.
Yeah, me too. Do they do it at that cafe we go to after recording?
And if you get it in a dinner, I think, Angela.
Yeah, fair enough. So the Thermidor reaction was the reaction to the fall of Robespierre and his Committee for Public Safety and the Law of Suspects and all of that. And it sort of marked the start of a period of political realignment, another one.
Yep.
And this move away from radicalism and sort of rampaging through the countryside, lopping off heads.
Yes, and the purge of the Jacobins led to the establishment of a new governing body called the Directory. And the period between 1795 and 1799 was characterised by more conservative and moderate approach. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we could go into it into more detail. It's not like nothing happened in those 4 years, but, you know, time and all that. And we've
done, like the bloodshed. You know, we like the bloodshed, really.
I want my lobster. So, you know, it's not that nothing happened in that period. Don't write in, but I just want to skip to the end, you know. And so the directory was in place until the rise of a certain young general, John, who'd made his mark in the Revolutionary Wars earlier on.
Yeah.
And his name was, dun, 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 Napoleon Bonaparte.
Ah, yes.
And during a coup in 1899, known as the 18 Brumaire. So when did it happen, John?
When it was misty, miss.
That's right, when it was misty in the autumn. Yes, during that coup, Napoleon would overthrow the directory and establish the consulate, concentrating power in his hands. But that is quite literally another story. So I did it, John.
That's not bad going.
I galloped through the French Revolution in an episode.
In an hour, that's pretty amazing.
Pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it is, you know, I've sort of said I don't never want to think about it. It was fascinating. And, you know, I've done a lot of reading this week and I've tried to condense the bits that I think are the most important points.
No, you have.
What I think is really interesting about it, sort of 235 years on,
yeah,
is how the historiography of it has changed, how the sort of explanations and the views of it and the way of looking at the French Revolution has changed over that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And how you view the revolution depend largely on where you are, who you are, and when you are, I suppose.
Yeah.
So contemporary writers about the revolution were divided among the same ideological lines as those in France, with conservative writers supporting a royalist point of view, radical writers supporting Republican view.
Yeah, exactly. In 1790, one of the most famous contemporary writers in Britain about it was a guy called Edmund Burke, the Anglo-Irish Whig MP. And he wrote Reflections on the Revolution in France in 1790. So before Robespierre, before all that, just after the Bastille. And so there was still a monarchy. And unsurprisingly, he was of the view that the Ancien Régime had provided stability. You know, there wasn't really anything wrong with it. Yeah. It only required some moderate reform. So he wrote that the revolution should be a sort of warning to anyone getting any revolutionary ideas. Because obviously the people on the continent weren't, you know, too happy about this giving ideas to their own poor people, and sort of felt that the whole thing served as a warning why it's best to leave things alone. And his book really is a sort of basis of conservatism as we know it.
Wow. But then more radical historians like Albert Mathies in the late 19th century and into the early 20th century presented a sort of more Marxist view of what happened. He argued that the revolution was a result of class conflict between the aristocracy and the bourgeoisie, and was followed by a conflict between the bourgeoisie and the sans-culottes, who were essentially the proletariat. Marxist historians would say that the violence, the terror, was necessary to defend the democratic republic.
Yeah, the Marxist interpretation was really popular, particularly in France, I think, up until really the middle of the 20th century. But I suppose it becomes less easy to defend le terreur in the name of the revolution once you've seen what people like Stalin were up to.
Yes.
You know, you say, oh, yeah, violence is necessary, and there's killing 30,000 to 50,000 people is bad enough.
Yeah.
When you killed millions in the name of revolution, it starts to get a bit harder to defend it, I think.
Yes. There's a good book on it. If you just want to read one book, very much in the spirit of our podcast, Mark Steele wrote a book about the revolution.
And Vive la Revolution.
Yeah, and I gave him a quote for that, which sums up my attitude to it, which is, if the revolution was led by Mark Steele, it might not be such a terrible idea. The trouble is, his sense of humour is so good, he'd be killed in the first month.
Yes.
And that's sort of what I feel about revolutions.
Exactly.
Is that, you know, far better to go leafleting for the Labour Party is what I'm going to do.
That's my sort of revolution.
So democracy, not terror. And, you know, it always goes horribly wrong when you have violent overthrows. There's always a backlash. You always have the terror. You always have the show trials of Stalin or Pol Pot or the massacres in Indonesia in 1965. There's always a horrible backlash. That's my two cents, Angela.
I think you're right. When you use violence, you justify violence as a means to get what you want, it is going to come back and bite you in the arse.
That's it. Did with Robespierre, mate.
You should have seen
that coming.
So, loads of reading you can do on this. I think Simon Sharma wrote a very famous Citizens, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, that's right, yes.
I think he felt that the violence was there from the beginning in the French Revolution. I've not read it.
And watch Les Mis. Watch Les Mis, Angela.
Watch Les Mis and let them eat cake.
That's right. John knows
I'm rocking now, John. I'm rocking and tapping my hands on the table. But yeah, do read Mark Steele's book, Vive la Revolution, because it's a good account of the things that happened in the revolution, but also, obviously, because Mark Steele's written it, it is really bloody funny.
Yes.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you, everyone. Patreon supporters, we thank you for your continued support. If you're not a Patreon supporter, then why not bung us a couple of quid each month so we can carry on?
We can carry on doing this. It's patreon.com. I can see John frantically trying to find the website address, but I'll just say it. It's patreon.com/wearehistory.
Yeah, and there's a few recent supporters we'd like to give a shout out to. So a big thank you to Duncan Robertson,
Nigel Corbett,
and Rosie McCaig. Thank you for your support, guys. That really helps us make this thing.
And the other thing that really helps us is if you go onto Apple Podcasts or wherever you hear your podcast, if it has a place where you can review us, please do that, because that helps us get us up the old listings and for people to find us. And please tell your friends, you know, put it on your social media, tell people to download and listen if you enjoy it, because we like making it and we want to keep making it if we can.
If you don't, you will be guillotined.
That John said that, not me.
Okay, see you next week, guys.
Bye.
We Are History is written and presented by Angela Barnes and John O'Farrell, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The lead producer is Anne-Marie Luff, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison, with artwork by James Parrott. We Are History is a Podmasters production.